Welcome to the Send Parenting Podcast. I'm your neurodiverse host, Dr. Olivia Kessel. And more importantly, I'm mother to my wonderfully neurodivergent daughter, Alexandra, who really inspired this podcast. As a veteran in navigating the world of neurodiversity in a UK education system, I've uncovered a wealth of misinformation, alongside many answers and solutions that were never taught to me in medical school or in any of the parenting handbooks. Each week on this podcast, I will be bringing the experts to your ears to empower you on your parenting crusade. In this episode, we will be speaking with Sarah Fisher, author of Connective Parenting, a guide to connecting with your child using the NVR approach. NVR stands for nonviolent resistance. Sarah is a single mother who's faced her own uphill battles and challenges with her neurodiverse adopted son. She found the light at the end of the tunnel with the NVR approach. If you've ever struggled as a parent with your child and their emotional regulation, this is the podcast for you. So welcome, Sarah. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on the Send Parenting podcast today. I was actually introduced to your book, Connective Parenting, when I was at an absolute crisis point with my daughter, Alexandra, and I had actually gone to get her assessed at a center, and I was speaking to the clinical psychiatrist, and I said, you know, regardless of what her diagnosis is, I cannot cope right now with this, you know, immense or intense, or both immense and intense, explosions of emotions that were just, you know, kicking, biting, screaming. And so I said to her, I need something now before the diagnosis, you know, or even if she doesn't have, you know, what I think she has, which was ADHD. And so she referred me to your book and the concept of nonviolent resistance. And honestly, like for me, nonviolent resistance was something that was, you know, a form of peaceful political kind of protest, which, you know, some of my greatest political heroes, Gandhi and Mandela, you know, used. And I've, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, if they could work for them, you know, maybe,
maybe
they could help me with this little firecracker I have in my house right now. Yeah. So, you know, and your book really did revolutionize and give me some really good tools. So I wanted to meet you, and I wanted to share with my audience on the Send Parenting podcast what the techniques are and, you know, how other parents could use them in your home. But I think your story is actually interesting to start off with, like, because I think you also went through your own journey with your own child, which kind of led you to this. So can you share that with us?
Yeah, of course. So yeah, I'm a solo adopter. So I've got he's now 17, which is a scary thought.
Time flies.
Seven. I know time really does fly. I'm like, oh my God, how's he 17 already? And it was really tough when he first moved in. You know, he had huge levels of trauma. He's also neurodivergent. He has ADHD and autism. That's only recently been diagnosed because the trauma was hiding it and he was masking incredibly well. So we've kind of, you know, it's been bubbling away. We're kind of like always those, has he, hasn't he, what's going on? And post-COVID, it became very obvious that he was definitely neurodivergent in terms of being autistic and ADHD. But those first few months when he moved in, it was awful.
How old was he, if you don't mind my asking?
When he moved in.
He was seven when he moved in. Okay, and that's kind of where...
Very small seven-year-old, I have to say. It was very small for his age, which in some ways was great because I could pick him up and carry him around, which you can't always do with a seven-year-old, but he was wearing kind of... I suppose his five-year-old height, so he was much smaller. He had incredible big emotions. We had huge meltdowns regularly. He was physically very aggressive, with his meltdowns. Not because he's not, as I'm sure your daughter is, an amazing, kind, caring child, just because the emotions were so big and he didn't know how to express them. And our kids don't, do they? They don't have that knowledge. You know, we're in our mid-20s before we can fully self-regulate. We can't be asking a 6, 7, even a 15-year-old to totally self-regulate themselves, but he really couldn't.
And interestingly, with neurodiversity and with trauma as well, I mean, it's proven through brain scans that their brains actually, in terms of self-regulation, are about 30 to 40% behind their peers. So they actually physically aren't able to, you know?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is 10 years ago, our knowledge of attachment, trauma, neurodiversity just wasn't where it is now. The neuroscience wasn't there in the way it is now. And I didn't know what to do. You know, I tried everything. I'd worked in schools for years, not teaching, but on the non-teaching side. I was a mentor with the Prince's Trust in the UK. I'd been out to Kosovo after the war and worked with kids out there. I spent my whole life working with kids in different fields. I thought, oh, I'll be fine. I could do this. No problem. It's parenting malarkey. Can't be that hard, can it? You know? I was like, oh, man, how wrong was I? I mean, I couldn't have been more wrong. And I remember before my son moved in, saying to the social worker, no, I never shout. I'm with young kids all the time. I've never shouted at a child. And my son moved in, this screaming banshee appeared from somewhere. And I was like, whoa, where's she come from? Wow, what's going on? And it's actually quite scary for me as the parent, kind of going, I don't know what to do. And I'm struggling to stay calm because as you're probably, know, when your child is escalating and it's constant and they're really angry and just shouty, it's really hard to keep yourself as a parent regulated. And to be able to respond to them in a calm way. And after about 9 months after he moved in of some of the worst behaviour I can, you know, and really, really tough. We were incredibly lucky, I have to say. His school were phenomenal. They got us through. They got us through to that point. Without them, right. I don't know whether we would have made it. The support from them, genuinely, I will be forever grateful for the head teacher and his classroom teachers and the TA, actually the whole school, everybody at the school.
And that's lovely because that's really an unusual story, you know?
It was a really small school and to the point where they would ring me to check I was okay during the day.
Aww.
You know, because they knew like what happened in the morning. And I mean, we were often late for school, despite getting up at 5 in the morning. You know, like, how can you be late? We've been up 3.5 hours. We're still not making it to school on time. This is ridiculous. But it kind of went on like that. And I was trying to find a way through. I tried all the stuff, you know, rewards and consequences and the shouting and the not shouting and the pushing and the, not pushing, but I mean, encouraging and the not encouraging. I tried everything I could think of. Bribery, reward charts, you know, you name it, I'd done it. And nothing seemed to be changing. And I was like, there's got to be a better way. There has to be something that worked. And when you adopt in this country, you until the adoption order goes through, you have social workers working with you all of the time. And after it was about 8 months, it was in the December. Coming up 9 years ago. About 9 years ago now, she gave me this piece of paper and she said, here, I found this course on MVR. I don't know what it is. Do you want to go? Might help. And it just talked about violence. I was like, I'm there, whatever. I'm there. Get me there. I don't care. I'll go. And I went up to London. It was a 1-day workshop because back then that was the only help that was around. And I remember sitting in a room with, I'm guessing, 50 odd other parents, maybe more. You know, your memory's a bit like vague. I came away, thinking, wow. Oh, this is life changing. This is what I need. I've got it. I know what I need to do. But also feeling really lucky. Feeling really lucky I'd found this when he was only, he was 8 at that point. He was 8. That I didn't have a teenager putting knives towards me. That I didn't have anything like physically, nothing had been broken. My kitchen was still in one piece. You know, I didn't have holes in my, and I thought, that's wrong. I shouldn't feel lucky. I haven't had those experiences. And I came away.
But you could see that trajectory if there wasn't something to stop it.
The parents in the room were there. That's what their experience was. And so I felt lucky that I'd found this when he was so young, that I'd found it early enough before things. And I genuinely came away with, I can change this. I can change what's going on for us at home. I've got it. And I came away with my notes and I remember reading them again on the train on the way home going, right, where do I start? I'm trying to help. What do I do first? And I just started putting it into practice, the bits I could do as I could. I wasn't getting it right because we never do when we're trying to change our own behaviours. And of course, our bodies by this point are already on heightened alert. You know, when you're experiencing that as a parent, your body's really heightened. So actually it goes into a reaction, even if your brain's going, it's okay, I want to respond differently. I started putting it into place. That was the end of January.
So when you say putting it into place, for listeners out here who don't know NVR at all, can you share with us, like, what is it and what are you supposed to do and what are you going to put in place?
So there are I'll tell you my school of thought around it and how I've developed it, because I've changed it to adapt for neurodiversity, because some people teach it in a way that doesn't work for neurodiversity and trauma.
Well, neurodiversity is what the podcast is about. So that you're preaching to a...
We know neurodiverse brains work differently. You know, they work differently. So the most important thing actually is, as parents, we're looking after ourselves. If we're not looking after our own emotional and physical health, and we're not connected to our own emotions, how can we help our child connect to theirs? How can we help them regulate in that moment? I don't know about you, but I know when I'm tired, when I'm stressed, you know, if I haven't eaten properly, I'm more grumpy, my patience is less, you know, all of those things that impact how we respond to our child. So for me, that's the kind of the baseline. We have to be putting ourselves at least on our list in terms of doing something for ourselves. After that, the focus and like the central pillar is really around parental, what we call parental presence. So being really present with our child in a physical and an emotional sense. So we all know that we might spend all day with your child. You might be with them all day, but they haven't got your undivided attention all day. It's not possible. It's not because we're parenting badly, just because it's not possible, you know. And so it's around finding ways where you create a true connection with them. But it might be 10 minutes of sitting on the floor playing trains or watching Lego, but you put your phone down, you put your book down, the telly's off, whatever. And it's just you and your child totally focused on whatever your child wants to do. So I know
it's connection.
Yeah, it's that attention. It's that connection. It's that attention. It's not, I want to go for a walk, so you're coming with me for a walk. That's what we're doing. It's, what would you like to do right now? And it's showing interest in them. And absolutely, you know, sometimes that means watching the same episode of a TV program for the 8 millionth time. And you're like, oh, I can't watch this again. It's so boring. But if that's what they want to do, that's what you do. Because when we show interest in our child, when we show time, when we show them we want to be with them, their self-belief, their self-love, their all of those things increase. And actually, that's a really positive thing. If you like yourself, if you know that you are accepted for who you are, you start to believe in yourself more over time. And when they get that undivided time, they also start opening up and talking about things. But it can take weeks or months, depending on your child, to get to that point where they start saying, actually, Mum, this happened at school, and not happy with it. But it's that spending time with them. So that presence raising, and also showing them throughout the day that you recognize their emotions. So I can see that you're really worried about something now, or I can see you're getting really angry because whatever's happened has happened. Or I can see you're really happy, that you're really enjoying playing with your toys, and helping them to see that you see their emotions, that you recognize them, and that it's okay. Because we all know being angry is okay. You know, it's not a lovely emotion. It's not one we all want to feel, but it's an okay, it's a normal emotion. What isn't okay is maybe the explosion that comes down, comes with that, you know, that anger. If it's dangerous towards somebody else, or if it's rude, you know, because sometimes those meltdowns become quite violent and aggressive. And that's not okay, because it's not safe for the child or whoever's around them. But the emotion itself is okay. So when we're raising our presence, we're saying, I see you as you, and I accept you for who you are. I'm here to help and support you and show you that I love you, whatever. Whatever's going on, I love you. We absolutely have boundaries around what isn't acceptable. You know, it's not about saying, just let them get away with whatever it is they're doing that isn't acceptable. But it's about holding those boundaries with true and genuine connection and acceptance of who they are. Yeah. And that's the fundamental, I suppose, the central pillar of it. And so many parents, when we work with them, and when I've worked with them, when we raise our presence, things start to change. There's that kind of ripple effect.
I think it was also really powerful for me, is because I felt so out of control in the situation with my child, and I couldn't control her. My authoritarian parenting toolbox was not working at all. You know, it was useless.
And that's really disempowering, isn't it? As the parent, you then feel
now what?
Yeah. And you're then like, what am I supposed to do? My child's in control. This is right. Oh, Lord. And of course, then you start getting all the feedback around you. Well, if you were stricter, if you were harsher, if you did this, and you're like, don't you think I've tried that?
And then you look at other children of the same age, and they're, you know, they're making their lunches. They're cooking dinner. I mean, you know, the list goes on, and you're like, So I thought it was really powerful that, you know, your first step kind of is to take it, you know, all the parenting classes out there, they're about how you can help your child's condition. But this kind of says, you know what, you need to change yourself first off.
Yeah.
And the only person you really have power to change really in life is yourself,
yeah.
You know? So it's not easy because like you say, you're in that heightened emotional state with your child. They know how to trigger you. And it's almost like a dance that you've choreographed before that, you know, the flame goes and then
yeah.
You both
and
go.
It is the norm. So actually both of you are so used to that norm that it's hard to change it. But if you think about, as you said, we can only control ourselves. We can only decide how we respond. Okay, sometimes our body takes over, but we can only do it. If we respond differently, we get a different response.
Yeah.
And yes, it takes time, but we get a different response. And so when we remain calm, when we help them, and I often talk about harbor walls, we're our child's harbor walls. We keep them safe. So when they've got big emotions and they're scary and they're big and they don't know what to do, we're putting kind of harbor walls around them and saying, I've got you. I've got this. It's okay. I'm here for you. I can help you manage this. Don't worry. We've got this together. And that's when, you know, when we think about de-escalating. So those issues where they are going up, when all their emotions are heightened, if we go up with them, as you said, we're just adding fuel to the fire and it all just goes horribly wrong.
And you have some of your worst parenting moments, yeah. If I'm honest, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when you say something you regret or you do something. I grounded my son for his entire life in the heat of an argument one day. I'm like, what was that about? You know, I mean, to be fair, it worked brilliantly as a de-escalation strategy because he just stopped and looked at me and went, what? So I was like, yeah, that's a really bad idea. You know, you just say stupid things in the heat of the moment because your brain is totally frazzled. Was if we can stay calm and say to Chachi, I've got this, I'm here. I can help you process these different emotions and these big emotions and these scary emotions and kind of, I don't know, absorb them for the child and help them to process it in a safer way, then they start to feel safe. And actually they come down when they're ready as well and their body starts to feel safer.
How would you practically advise a parent
to do that? So in the moment, the thing to remember is we're focusing on our regulation as the adult. And through that, we're helping our child to regulate. So we're co-regulating them. So we're not telling them to calm down. As you said earlier, our children, they don't know how to. It's completely put that phrase, you just need to calm down, is one of the most useless phrases in the English language. Because
or take a breath. My daughter, like if I say take a breath, I might as well be like lighting a match. She's like, I'm not going to take a breath.
Absolutely.
And I have to be honest, when she tells me to take a breath, I have the almost exact same reaction because when you're in that, you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my son de-escalates me now because we've done it so many times that if I'm the one going up, which, you know, does happen sometimes, he now uses all the strategies on me. And there's part of me that's really proud. It's like, oh, he knows what to do. Isn't it amazing? And it's not, you know, because I'm like, don't you de-escalate me. And it's really interesting the response you have in your own body. But in the moment as the parent, focus on your regulation. And that will be what works will be different. So you're going to have to it's a bit of trial and error to find out what works for you. So things that work for me, oh, I love a bit of humor and as does my son. So being a bit silly, doing something silly, you know, trying the latest TikTok dance, saying something silly, whatever it is, speaking in a silly voice, those things just help me regulate. And actually they help my son regulate because humor works for us, but it doesn't work for everybody. And definitely don't use it if you're just at boy, do you mean if you're like, they're just about to explode, avoid humor like the plague because nothing is funny at that point. Nothing is funny. But that works, sensory stuff. So particularly if your child is neurodivergent, sensory is going to be a big thing for a lot of them. So you could, deep breathing does work, you know, blowing raspberries can work. Jumping up and down on the spot, kitchen disco, you know, if they like music, turn on the favorite music and just have a bit of a boogie because that movement is getting everything flowing. It's getting rid of the stress hormones in their body. What else works? Things like push-ups against the wall, singing, if they like singing, anything like that, giving them something chewy or crunchy to eat, having it yourself. Because how often if you go and get a biscuit or get some, you know, a carrot stick to eat, the children turn around and go, what are you eating? And if nothing, they might ask for it, but that distraction also can help just take the edge off things as well. So anything sensory, even just giving them something to fidget with, you know, unless they're a thrower. If they like throwing in the heat of the moment, don't put something in their hands because it's coming back at your head at some point. So don't put something in your hands, in their hands. But anything sensory like that can really, even having a drink, you know, a drink through a sports bottle, that sucking action, or a straw, that sucking action is really good for regulating. So those kind of sensory things in the moment can help. You want to try and catch them as early as possible, though. Because if they're too far into the meltdown, as we know as adults, once you're really angry, it takes a while to come back down. So you want to try and catch them before they're really escalated.
And you had a really great example in your book, which when I read it, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I could ever do this. It was about, you know, I think turning off the, wanting to turn off the TV for something. And do you remember it? You want to share that example? Because it's kind of like, for me as the authoritarian parent toolbox, it was really putting that aside. And I read it and I was like, really?
But think about when you're watching your favorite TV program and you're sitting there and you're totally engrossed and it's in the middle of the program. If I walk in and say, switch that off now, we're going out. Most of us as adults wouldn't be that happy because we don't want to switch it off because we're totally engrossed in the program. Except we expect children to be able to do exactly that. So if you walk in and say, switch it off now, that's what's happening, you are going to get a little bit of back chat. If you're lucky, that's all you're going to get. Do you know what I mean? Otherwise, you're going to get a big explosion. If we go in and sit with them for a little bit, start getting their attention away from it, engage with them, then we can start to move away. I'll say, when this finishes in 15 minutes, can you turn it off for me? And do something with them before you're asking them to go and do something calm. It's the same if you're asking them to come off their Xbox or whatever game they're playing, or their, you know, their iPad, whatever. They're heightened. If we're asking them to come from that really zoned in focus of I'm watching this TV program, I'm playing with that game, they're totally zoned in on it and they're really heightened at the same time. Come and sit with me at the table quietly. Which is a lot of kids' idea of sensory hell, sitting at the dinner table eating dinner with their families. You can't ask them to go from one to the other calmly because they just can't do it. Their body's in the wrong place to be able to then sit at the table. Whereas if you can sit down, talk to them, engage with them before you ask them to come off the TV program or whatever it is, and start to just broaden their view again and start to get them thinking, oh, there's a world away from the screen. Thank you very much. You know, didn't realize that existed. Then you can get them a little bit calmer and do something while you're walking to the table or whatever it is you're going on to do. So you move them from one state to another, because I'm quite grumpy when you tell me to tell my favorite TV program off in the middle of it, or you come and talk to me in the middle of it. I don't like it, but we expect kids to do it.
It's that transitioning, isn't it, from one scene to another, and also, you know, being maybe doing something you don't want to do when you've been doing something you really enjoy doing.
Yeah, and you know, none of us like doing that. Yeah. You know, we're all great at procrastinating if we've got to go and do something we don't want to do.
Yeah, going to bed for my daughter, and it goes from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing, and I'm like, ah,
yeah. Yeah.
But now we've developed, we sing a song, a cucaracha or conga, 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 and the dog and all of us, we have a dance move up the stairs and she enjoys that. So
it is that movement, isn't it? And kids will wait until you say, it's time to turn the light out, and they have to tell you everything that happened all day. And you're like, really? You've had all day to tell me all of this stuff. Why are you doing it right now? Why are you doing it right now? But that's interesting. A, that's a great diversion tactic. We all know that one. But also when you're present more during the day, some of that bedtime processing that they need to do comes out in those moments of presence during the day. So when you're sitting on the floor playing Lego with them, even if you're like, oh, God, I'm so bored doing this, that some of that processing that's happening at bedtime when they suddenly need to talk to you will start happening in those moments. So those bedtime things, there's less that needs to be processed because they've done it some of it earlier in the day.
I guess the proof was in the pudding for you, because here you have this child, and you came back from London on the train with your notes and you put it into practice. What happened? Like,
so it, There's no magic wand. Just if anybody's going, oh, I found a magic wand, this will happen overnight. It doesn't, does it? Change does not happen overnight. It takes time.
Especially for yourself, your own self-change. It's very, very hard.
It is. And that's why it takes time. You know, we have to, and I remember putting stuff into practice and sometimes going, oh, just I've not done what I wanted to do, you know. I did lose it. I did end up showering. I still do sometimes now because, you know, whatever reason.
We're human,
yeah. And I started putting it into practice, literally just the bits I could A, work out, and B, remember, and B, was in a, you know, I'd seen a place to do. So I tried to think more about presence and doing the things he enjoyed, which I was quite present, but I'm not very good at like imaginary play. That's not my thing, but I realized I had to really focus on it because it's what he enjoyed doing. I started really managing those escalatory situations differently and they started to reduce. It took, by the May, things were really, really different at home, much, much calmer, much calmer. By the September, so that's what, about 8 months later, when I trained professionally and like retrained, we didn't have any violence at that point and it completely stopped. And since then, I mean, I'm not going to tell you I have a totally calm 17-year-old. That would be a lie. He has his moments, 100%. I have my moments. But we have a really good relationship on the whole. Yeah, he's struggled a bit in the last 18 months, as lots of kids have post-COVID, going back out into the world. But he's doing really well and we have a good relationship on the whole. And he does talk to me about what's going on. I use a lot of humour because it works in this house. You know, it doesn't work everywhere. But I've continually worked on, I suppose, myself. And I think that's one of my big messages for us as parents. We have to think about what triggers me. And how do I respond in that moment? You know, and am I getting triggered because, you know, my son won't sit at the table and eat in the way that I think he should sit at the table and eat because of the way I've been brought up? You know, if that's a trigger, then what's the reason for it triggering me? Does it matter, you know, if we don't have dinner at the table every night? No. Our connection time's at a different time. You know, so for us, actually, I can't remember the last time we ate at the table together. I mean, apart from like, you know, we go to restaurants and Christmas dinner and those kind of things, but the rest of the time, no. But we have our connection time at different times that works for both of us. And it's understanding, as the parent, understanding your own triggers and thinking, okay, why am I responding the way I am in those moments? You know, what is it about me? And when we can start unpicking that, which isn't a quick process, then we can really see the significant long-term change with our child because we start to respond differently. And I don't think we can ask our child to respond to their own triggers differently if we're not prepared to do the same. You know, if we're not prepared to do
that same work, I mean, there's definitely,
it's not fair to them to.
And also I felt this myself, that my behavior is being modeled by her to a degree as well, both of our emotional dysregulation. So I'm perpetuating something I don't want to perpetuate. So until you can, you know, model the behavior, and it can't be fake because kids know when you're faking it, you know, you actually, which is terrible. So this is not something you can fake it till you make it kind of thing. You really have to. And like you said, it doesn't always work, but I can't remember who said this, but there's like the 30-70%. If you can get it right 30% of the time, you're doing, and I do have to sometimes say that to myself, you know, and even she will say to me, "Mommy, you did really good." Like if she's having a complete tantrum before bed and I've kept calm, she's like, "Mommy, you've done really well." I'm like, yay. Other times I'm just like, I'm sorry.
But we do get it wrong sometimes. You've got to love kids when they say, "Well done." You're just like, really, really? Thanks a lot. Glad you approve. But I think there's also a power in modeling when we get it wrong. You know,
yeah, that's true.
It's okay to get it wrong sometimes because none of us is perfect. And this is what you do, you know? Yeah. And I'm not a big believer in making kids say sorry. The words "I'm sorry" are meaningless if there's not genuine like feeling behind it and meaning. But having those conversations afterwards when things have calmed down and saying, "Now, how are you feeling? What's going on for you? I can see you're really upset. How can I help?" You know,
yeah, I thought that was really powerful.
You know, yeah. How can I help you when you're feeling like that next time? You know, because.
And I liked what you said in the book because you said, you know, don't talk it through with them and say, you know, your insights of wisdom or, you know, this is what I'm here to teach you, because actually that doesn't help anything, you know? So to stop talking and to do what you just said there, that reflective listening and that, you know, hearing their emotions is so important. And I think sometimes we feel as parents we're supposed to impart this wisdom on our children. It doesn't help.
It doesn't. And we go into lecture mode if we're not careful. Yes. And then they've switched off. You know, they're not listening anyway. You're just lecturing and you're feeling better as the parent going, I've told them what to do. Thank you very much. I've solved my problem. And your child's going, whatever. I didn't listen to a word of it. So it's fine. You know, it doesn't move you forward. And then I think if we work with them, they understand and they can actually use that. Then as they get older, gradually they start to go, oh, actually, if I'm in this one, I can do it like this. And we're teaching them the skills they need. We're not just, imparting knowledge. And what works for me wouldn't work for you. And what works for me wouldn't work for my son. We're all different. And I think part of really accepting who our children are is helping them understand who they are and being really comfortable in their own skin.
Yeah.
Being able to advocate and say, actually, that doesn't work for me. I need this, please. You know, or I'm feeling really like this in a classroom. I need to step outside for 10 minutes if the school will be supportive, you know. But it's all of those bits. And those conversations for me have, I'm going to say, being a game changer, and I truly believe they are. And for so many of the families we work with, they are game changers. They're scary to have sometimes because you're like, don't want to go back and mention it again because it might all flare up. But actually, if you do it in the right way, if you go in and say, I'm really sorry you're upset earlier on, you know, can I help? You know, do you want to talk about it? Or, you know, what was happening? Or what could I do? Or, you know, and be reflective. It's not that I need to talk to you about what happened earlier on because that wasn't good enough. Well, most of us would leg it out of the room if someone spoke to us like that, you know, and we don't want to talk and our barriers go up. So it's really, how do we start that conversation? And, you know, it is that reflective listening. It's listening to them. It's working with them. It's helping them. And from that, you move forward.
Yeah. And it just changes the whole dynamics is what I found, you know. And I found also the writing of the announcement that you write for yourself as a parent and then you share with your child. I thought that, you know, and I did this. So for our listeners, basically you write kind of what you want to forgive yourself for in terms of your, you know, perceived bad parenting as a mother and, or actually, we're harsh critics as well. I think, you know, the judgment is high and, you know, it was painful to write it. I cried and I'm not a cryy person, but it was like almost lancing a boil and it was necessary to kind of almost, you know, what we talked about earlier about, you're in a heightened state. It kind of got rid of some of that heightened state. And then sharing a different version with my daughter was also really important. So I think that's a really, and sorry to backtrack in terms of, you know, what you're sharing with your child, because we hadn't mentioned that you know, not trying to change everything, you know, or not trying to solve everything. So focusing on one thing versus everything, where you kind of are the shrew like nagging mother that, you know, is walking around bombshells. That was also really key. So maybe you could talk a little bit about putting triaging is the way I would look at it from my medical background.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to pick up what you said about forgiving ourselves, because I think it's so important, because we carry on and we hold it and actually just becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it impacts more and more things. So forgiving ourselves for the things that we wish we hadn't done, said, whatever, is so, so important. And actually it's a thing we've got to help our kids learn as well. We've got to help our kids learn to let go of those things. And if we can't do it for ourselves, how are we going to teach our kids to do it?
So true.
I think it's really, really important that we do that. And then the triage, I love that word, the triaging things, absolutely. We tend to deal with everything all of the time, don't we? You know, I've got to sort this out, I've got to sort that out. And you've got 28 trillion plates you're trying to spin all at the same time. And it just doesn't work. One of them or all of them are going to end up on the floor. And if you put them on the floor, that's very different to them just smashing on the floor because you can't keep control of it. So with this approach, we are basically saying, which of these plates am I going to stop spinning and put on the floor? And which one or two am I going to keep spinning and actually really focus on? It's going to be different for everybody. I always suggest to parents, write down. So if you are listening to this, grab a piece of paper when we finished, obviously. Write down everything that annoys you, you think is unacceptable, is dangerous, is, you know, all of those things. Get them all out of your head. And it doesn't matter whether you've got four things on the list or like 4,000. I mean, obviously, I've seen steam come off parents' pens when they write these lists sometimes. You're like, whoa, that's quite a long list. But just get everything out. And if you're parenting as a couple, both of you write the list separately and compare lists, because it's really interesting how you have different things on your lists. and different things will trigger different parents. So you might not even know that your other half is triggered by. So it's quite interesting just to understand that. And then look at your list or your lists and pull out your top one or two things. What are the things you need to deal with first? And if you've got, you know, unsafe behaviors, be that self-harm, violence towards others, even, you know, a lot of verbal aggression, I'm going to suggest they're on the top of the list because they're not safe and you need to keep everybody safe. That could also be really avoidant behavior. So if you've got a child who's really, really avoidant, that might be top of your list, you know, because that's not necessarily safe either. But those behaviors that go at the top of your list, and then things that I'm going to say the smaller things. Now, I know there's going to be some parents about to listen to what I say and go, that's not a smaller thing, Sarah. I can't let that go. But you need to let them go for now. Literally put them to one side. And so that could be anything from the fact that they come in and they drop their bag in one place and one school shoe one place and one school shoe in another room and their blazer somewhere else. And then, you know, they get undressed and they don't put things in the laundry basket. They put it in the vague vicinity of the laundry basket. You know, if you're lucky, it goes somewhere near the laundry basket or it's shoved under the bed or down the back of the wardrobe or wherever it is, you find it. And the dirty plates that have become a science experiment and you're trying to work out what it was they actually were originally. And maybe they don't say goodnight to you in the way they want to. Maybe they eat with their fingers at the table. Maybe they are, I don't know, they won't do their homework. Another one that comes up a lot of the time. All of those things, you want to try and ignore them for now. So that's not to say you don't ever say to them, could you put your dirty clothes in the laundry basket? But you don't nag. If they don't do it, you just leave it and you get on with it. I know that's really hard. It's really hard not to nag with those things. You're like, oh, how hard is it?
And talking about those earlier triggers, they're my, you know,
they are.
Alignment.
Yeah, you know, wet soggy towels left on the bathroom floor. Especially, like, how hard is it to hang it up afterwards, you know?
Or when they get it so close to the laundry basket, but not in the laundry basket, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Or on top of the laundry basket, because opening the lid and putting it in
is too much of an effort. Yeah.
Too much. And you're just like, I don't understand. But those things, what happens is when we nag about them, our children are like, ugh, they're going on about it again. And actually, a lot of them, it makes them not want to do it even more. And it raises our, you know, our hackles, our shackles. We get more wound up. We're more likely to get triggered. We get more frustrated. We get a little bit more, and that doesn't help. When we stop talking about those, or maybe mention it once and then go quiet, those little things often either stop happening if it's something you want to stop happening, or start happening, if that makes sense. So if it's put clothes in the laundry basket, things actually start appearing in the laundry basket, and you're a bit like, whoa, that's a bit weird. There's something in the laundry basket. But maybe those things you don't want them to do, like leave the plates under their bed, their plates start coming downstairs. You know, it's those little things, because we're not constantly going on and on and on. And often when we start picking at those smaller, in inverted commas, things, we end up with the bigger behaviours, because we've lifted the whole atmosphere in the house by our, I'm going to say nagging, because we are nagging basically, by our nagging, by our feelings of frustration, they're not happening. We raise our child's hackles, we raise ours, and we just end up in a big meltdown. So when we're not dealing with the smaller things for now, and all of our energy goes on when they are dysregulated, they're not violent, for example, they're not really shouty, whatever it is, then we A, stop those behaviours from happening because they're not safe, they need to stop. But the smaller things often start to reduce as well.
Almost like a side effect.
Positive connection. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. As you said, it changes the atmosphere. It changes the atmosphere for you as well. Yeah.
It really does. And if you have a child who is demand avoidant in any way, the more you ask them to do something, the more it's a demand.
Yeah.
So the less they're going to do it. And it's those things, but it's very hard as a parent sometimes to let those things go, because maybe that's how you were brought up, that you just did those things. It wasn't a debate. You just put your laundry
in. Or you got smacked if you didn't.
Yeah, literally. You know? So it was like, there was no question that you wouldn't do them. And so it's very hard to unwire it and go, okay, it's all right if our child doesn't do it. You know, it's all right if I pick the damn towel up off the floor and hang it up. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah. And you have to kind of disconnect that in your mind, because for some reason, or the way, you know, you've been raised, it does feel like you're not setting your child up for success because they're not doing any of these things. But actually you need to disassociate that, because actually you're being ridiculous. If the towel stays on the floor or makes it onto the rack is not going to determine their success in life. But somehow that's what it feels like as a parent.
It does. And those are the things that it makes so much different. But actually when you let them go, your levels of stress in your own body just drop.
It's liberating.
Why am I starting an argument over that? Something so small. I'm like, look, it's in the vague vicinity of the laundry basket. That'll do, you know? And I just think, why? Was I starting an argument? Because it doesn't change things. It doesn't mean the next time round they do what you want them to do. And it just creates more frustration in the house.
Yeah.
Actually, when you don't do it, you have more time for positive connection, you know, when you're not nagging them all the time. You know, when I say now to my son, I'm about to do the washing, can you do me a favor and make sure everything you need washing is on the landing, please? And he's like, it's in the laundry basket. I'm like, just go and check your bedroom for me, will you, mate? And he comes out and I'm like, with an armload of clothes, I'm like, and they were in the laundry basket? And he sort of looks at me and goes, yeah, maybe not. Precisely. And it's, you know, but we do it in a jokey way. And actually, I'm like, no, your clothes are going to get washed. You know, whereas if I hadn't said anything, actually, because I don't pick stuff up off his floor, because I'm like, I never know whether you want it washed or not. And you know what they're like? Oh, I was about to wear that. And you're like, really? It could have walked out the house by itself. It's so smelly, you know. But it's finding that way of doing it that creates a positive connection and doesn't escalate things in the house, because none of us want to live in a stressed house.
No.
It's not good for us.
It puts you at a different level than when you do go and address those, the big areas that you're talking about, the thing that's your number one or your number two priority that you want to accomplish. It puts you both in a different place.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, when you're focusing on those priorities, that's where you're de-escalating every time it happens. You're having those follow-on conversations and say, look, you know, when you are really angry, how can we help you so that you're not, I don't know, hitting, shouting, throwing things, whatever it is you're doing, because that's not safe. Or self-harming, yeah. You know, whatever it is, we need to help you find safe ways of expressing your emotion. So all of your energy goes on managing those things and you know, changing those. And it takes time and it takes effort from us as parents. And that's the difficult bit. If you are running on empty, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to do.
I know for me, like getting our sleep into a better place was really important for both of us in terms of our emotional regulation. And then also learning that for me, I need to exercise so that I can be calm. And, you know, it's interesting. My daughter, I hurt my knee and I couldn't run. And she's like, Mommy, you need to start. You need to run even if you're near. So I got a bike, but you know, but what's good is she's realizing it. And then she's saying to me, well, maybe I should go on the bike. Maybe I should do these things. And it's like, we're in it. It changes kind of the shift from a lot of parenting books, a lot of parenting advice, a lot of parenting classes, because in all of those, I found that it's more like, this is what we need to change about the child. Whereas in this methodology, we're in it together, kind of changing ourselves together. And we're both growing. And I think that's a unique thing about NVR that I experienced.
Absolutely. You know, I truly believe we cannot ask our child to do anything we're not willing to do ourselves. And, you know, so many of us as parents, and I'm not saying my parents didn't parent me really well, but they parented in a different way. It was a different generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, our children need us to help them, particularly post-pandemic. They need extra help with their emotional health, their mental health. We're living in a really different world. They're growing up with technology and social media that, thankfully, you know, we didn't have to grow up with. And it is putting different pressures on them. They need us to really support them with their emotional development and teach them how to do it, how to look after themselves and do it in a very different way and be more open about their emotions. But if we're not doing that, we can't ask them to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, with neurodiversities, their emotional self-regulation is already behind. And, you know, there is that learning process. But the amazing thing is when you put that support in place and you do allow them to mature at their own pace with you, then the magic happens, you know, and it no longer becomes a barrier.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the world needs neurodiverse people. They have a way of seeing it and a way of processing stuff that is just phenomenal. and different, and we need that difference. You know, if we were all the same, life would be pretty boring and we wouldn't have achieved everything we need to achieve.
And you know what's interesting is everyone's like, oh, it's such a hot topic now. And I'm like, but actually, if you look back in history, there's a lot of hot historical people who had neurodiversity. You know, Leonardo da Vinci, John F. Kennedy, John Lennon, to name but a few, Einstein. Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, yeah. But they had to kind of keep it secret, you know, whereas now we don't need to.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was having this conversation with my son the other day, and I just said, look, some of the world's biggest entrepreneurs are all neurodivergent. Because their brain works in a way that
60% of self-made millionaires are neurodiverse. 60%. That's, you know,
it's the way your brain works. It enables you to do things and see patterns that other people just can't do and see. And I said, that's a real bonus, you know, and I don't, that sounds awful, a bonus, but that's a real positive for me. It's something to see it in a really good way that, you know, I know some people still see being neurodiverse as a negative, and I'm like, to me, that's a huge positive, you know, and actually you just find your unique way of going out in the world and you have that confidence. And if we can help our children really believe in themselves, actually, whether they're neurodivergent or neurotypical, if they can believe in themselves and go, this is what I'm really good at, this is where I'm going, that's amazing, isn't it? That's what we need to do.
Absolutely. And you look at the mental, you know, health and the well-being of our children, it needs to be such a focus and a priority. And I think this methodology is a great way to grow both as a parent and as a child. And honestly, you know, if you were like me and like you, actually, you're at your rope's end.
Possibly past it at times.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, and I, you know, I also went down the untraditional route of being a single parent. I went through IVF, and, you know, I questioned myself, you know, did I make a really big mistake?
Yeah.
You know, am I actually able to be a mother? You know, was this a complete cock up of what I've done, you know, that I have now destroyed a child's life? But, yeah. You know, that's not the case, thankfully.
Definitely not. And I think, you know, our children hold a mirror up to us. They hold that mirror up of the things we need to work on.
It's so
and
true.
It's whether or not you're willing to work on those things.
Yeah.
You know? And it's not always that easy.
Yeah. They teach us more than we teach them, I think, at the end of the day.
Definitely.
Well, I always, Sarah, at the end of my podcast, and I have given you some warning because I would hate to just spring it on you, but I love to give three top takeaway tips. So, you know, what can people really take away? And there was a lot to take away in that in our discussion today, but what three top tips would you give our listeners?
So my first tip is actually how I started. It's put yourself on the list. You know, put yourself on your to-do list, ideally at the top of it, but somewhere on it, at least be on your list and make sure you're doing, looking after yourself, because parenting is tough. And if you're not topping your tank up and letting the stress go, it'll get on top of you and you'll get to the end of your rope, as we just talked about. So that's my first top tip. My second is find time every day to spend with your child, even if it is 2 minutes at bedtime, it doesn't matter. And if you've got 2, 3, 4 children in your house, try and spend time with each one of them every day, if you can, or at least a few times a week, where they are getting you undivided attention. And if you've got both of you parenting, like if you're a two couple house, both of you spend time with each of your kids, because they will have a different relationship. They might talk more to one parent than they do the other. Whichever way, you're creating those strong bonds and you're giving them space to feel safe and talk about whatever they need to talk about. And then lastly, something we haven't talked about, but that's build a village around you. Build your tribe of people who get it. You know, whether it's listening to podcasts like this, whether it's, you know, we've got a free Facebook group for parents who are trying to use this approach, whatever it is, get that tribe around you of people who get it. And you know,
it's one of the number one tips, I think, that all of the experts that come on this show say, because you can feel so alone and isolated, and that doesn't help you in your first tip, right? How can you take care of yourself if you don't have people that can resonate and can have been either walking in your shoes or ahead of you on the journey or behind you on the journey? It's so helpful.
Yeah, it really is. And I think we live in an increasingly isolated world where we don't have the communities that maybe we did have. I remember growing up, you know, all the kids, we all played together, all the parents knew each other. There was that kind of sense of community. And certainly where I am, we don't have that in that same way anymore. And I think it makes such a difference just to be able to ring somebody who goes, just rant if you need to. Jumping down the phone, it's fine. You're like, ah. Or goes, actually, I've just done this and this one. Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you. Because when you're so in it and dealing with something, you can't see literally the wood for the trees. And you need someone else who is somewhere, one who gets it, who can listen and maybe just give you that bit of take breath, take a step back, you know, do this.
You can do this.
Okay. I'm back on track. Thank you very much. See you later. You know, and off you go. But that's what we all need, you know, wherever we are on the journey. We all need that tribe around us.
I completely agree. Three great top tips. And I want to give you a big thank you for coming on the Send Parenting podcast.
No, it's been lovely. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, Send Parenting Tribe. If you haven't already, please follow us at Send Parenting Podcast on Instagram or visit us and comment on our website, sendparenting.com. It would be great to hear from you in terms of what topics or speakers you would like to hear next on the Send Parenting Podcast. Wishing you and your family a good week ahead.